Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Kevin Parker from Tame Impala.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to the first in a new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. It's always nice when the underground bends the mainstream towards it, like a light beam being put through a prism. This is what the music of my guest this week has done. Growing up in Perth, Western Australia, as a teen, his overwhelming obsession with music made him absorb every genre he came across. His entire life at the time was playing drums, playing guitar, singing and writing songs in his bedroom. And those songs found an audience, and that audience grew and grew. Now his entire life is playing drums, guitar, singing and writing songs and performing them for millions of people. My guest on The First Time this week is Kevin Parker from Tame Impala. Here we talk about Kevin's earliest musical influences, The Shadows, Fleetwood Mac and Thomas the Tank Engine, the moment his passion for music became an overwhelming force in his life, and the very earliest gigs that he played. We also discuss the birth of Tame Impala, the famously difficult creation of their debut album Inner Speaker, the huge expectation that followed the success of their breakthrough record, Lonerism, and how he feels about his current status as one of the most in-demand collaborators in the whole of the music world. And we might also chat a bit about his other stage headlining slot at next week's Glastonbury Festival. But I started by asking Kevin, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
I think I remember being in my dad's car. Like there's this kind of song, or it's kind of a band. I think it was The Shadows, but like, I've always tried to trace back to what it was. It was something that I just like, I don't know, I can barely remember it, but I was always asking him to put it on or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it was The Shadows.
For the sake of argument.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, other than like, you know, obviously like Thomas the Tank Engine and stuff. Obviously, other than like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like actual music. No, that's not true. Thomas the Tank Engine's great.
Did music play like an important role in the household? Was it a thing that was going on?
Yeah, definitely. My dad always had music playing, especially Saturday morning, Sunday morning kind of thing. It was very kind of like weekend euphoria kind of thing, you know. Well, not, you know, like euphoria, but like very atmospheric. They had the sort of hi-fi cranked, you know, and the doors open and stuff like that.
What sort of thing?
He would play Beach Boys, Supertramp, Fleetwood Mac often, that kind of thing. You get the picture, you know. And my mum also loves music, so she would do similar things. You know, she always had... Like a hi-fi was like an essential part of wherever we were, you know? My dad was very much a, like, best of kind of guy, which when I kind of grew up, it kind of annoyed me that I knew bands, but not by their albums, just by their kind of best of. Like, they were like CDs that I thought were the albums, you know? And it was just like songs that were sort of like 15 years apart and stuff.
What about the first piece of music that you bought that was yours? The first single or album or...?
First, would have been a CD. That would be one of the Batman movie soundtracks.
The Prince Batman one?
Unfortunately not. No, I was too young then. In hindsight, it's probably like the classiest one, obviously.
That's a weird choice for a first thing to own.
Well, I mean, it's just because I was obsessed with the movie. I saw the movie, and my mum took me, and, you know, I was like 7 years old or something, 8 years old, and I was just... blown away in the way that kids are by action movies, especially Batman. Still am, like, however many years later when the new Batman comes out. But I just remember the music was just like, it's impossible to say whether it's because I actually thought the music was sick or it was just because it was tied to Batman climbing around the city, you know? Like, so, but the CD had like U2, it had Mazzy Star, Method Man.
This is all good.
Flaming Lips, exactly. So, like, in retrospect, it was like, oh, really good music.
What about the first piece of music that kind of, when you reach that point and you're like, okay, now I'm a teenager, I know bands, this is my music, this is the group, because grunge was a big thing for you, wasn't it?
Probably Nirvana or Silverchair, you know, an entire album would just be, I just have it on kind of repeat. More so Silverchair, just because they were youngish, they were kind of like 15 when they got signed. And I kind of, and they were from Australia, they're from like a rural sort of part of Australia, which I immediately identified with. You know, like that's the kind of thing you don't really think about when you're that age, that like kind of stars, people that are successful, that are like you, you know, that you identify with, you fall in love with much easier. You know, I didn't realize that was a thing. I was just like, oh, these guys are sick, you know.
I come from Birmingham, and when I was a teenager, because I'm a bit older, I saw Duran Duran on TV, and I was like, Birmingham's in the Midlands. It's like not a particularly glamorous
place. Black Sabbath?
Yeah. And we were like, wow, you can be on like sort of in the Bahamas on a motorboat with models.
Yeah.
And you're from Birmingham?
Yeah.
What? Yeah, I get that. I get that thing.
In fact, I remember thinking like, okay, well, I'm 12 now. I got 3 more years. You know? I was like, 3 more years, and I've still got it there in time that Silverchair did.
What about the first gig you went to?
It's probably like a punk rock gig in Perth. It would have been an underage show. Like that me and a couple of friends would have been to. Just raucous kind of Australian punk music. Mosh pits and sweat and blood. Well, shoes flying everywhere.
Yeah, I remember those gigs. Shoes flying everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, like it was just this completely new thing. You know, go into a room and there's a bunch of other sweaty teenagers that are into the same music, and everyone's just going mental. It's like, whoa, what is this? This is crazy. This is not normal life. It was just, I was intoxicated by it, you know.
Was there whatever's happening in the audience in the mosh pit with I'm taking my shoe off and I'm throwing it around, but also I want to be doing this all the time.
Oh yeah, totally. Well, I mean, like I tried crowd surfing once. And, you know, like, I got up there, I didn't know what to do, so I just kind of, like, waved to the band, you know, in a kind of, like, I gave them a thumbs up or something, you know, like, in a kind of a worship way, you know? But that was well after I'd become obsessed with trying to become a rock star, you know? That was years after. Like, I hadn't been to a gig until years into it, you know? I just sit in my room with the guitar. So it was long established by then.
You saw the White Stripes. Was that a big one for you?
Oh yeah, that was my first
proper gig.
Proper gig that I used my brother's ID to get into. It was over 18s, and it was the night before like a big school exam, ancient history, I believe. The night before, and I had no friends that wanted to go because everyone was studying. Everyone made the responsible decision, and I was like, no, I'm going. There's no two ways about it, you know. So I borrowed my brother's ID. We don't look totally alike. We look similar, you know, similar kind of facial features. But he had totally different coloured hair. but lined up, got my, you know, had my ticket. I'd already bought my ticket. It was like $80 or something. And it was the night of my life. I was like, I can't believe I made it in, you know. I bought a beer. I was like, I'm going to buy a beer, you know.
What's the White Stripes track we should play?
I guess it's like Dead Leaves in the Dirty Ground. Just because like whenever I hear the start of that, it just reminds me of putting that album on. So, you know, it's just one of those like time warp albums where I'm just like, yeah, I can feel the table that my like homework table that I sat at when I listened to it.
We'll be right back.
This is
BBC Radio
6 Music.
After a fallow year,
the anticipation is immense.
I'd love to see you guys clap.
After a fallow year,
it's easy to forget the moments we've shared. The discoveries we've made there.
Let's go, we're having a great time.
Next weekend, the biggest festival in the world
is back.
Are you doing Glastonbury?
BBC Music at Glastonbury.
We'll get you in.
Glastonbury! Be ready!
For The Cure,
The Chemical Brothers,
Lauryn Hill, Vampire Weekend,
Lizzo,
Tame Impala, Loyal Kana,
Kamasi Washington,
and many more.
I said Glastonbury Energy!
Listen on BBC Sounds and watch on BBC iPlayer.
Okay, so say I come around this kind of era, I come around your place and I open the door to your bedroom and you're, what do I find? Tell me about the studious young man. What did it look like?
Well, depending on which part of my teenage years room you walked in on.
I mean, obviously,
very wildly.
Walking in on a teenage boy, it can be a dangerous thing. I'm more thinking about the kind of like, right, okay, I'm going to start tackling these instruments and I'm going to start making noises with them, kind of.
Around then, well, you know, it depends if it's my dad's place or my mum's place. So okay. I kind of went between. Dad's place was quite sort of clean. You know, I was sort of instructed to keep it quite clean. If it was messy, I'd get in trouble. So, and we had a music room. Like, my dad had a music room, so that was where all the junk was. Cool. So I only had like my guitar in the room. Everything else was amps and stuff from the music room. But my mum's place, when I lived there, that was like, I shared it with my brother. I slept on a stretcher, like one of those like kind of temporary beds, and junk everywhere. It smelled. I had my guitar, a little Samick amp that was about a foot high and wide, at a PlayStation, a little TV sitting on a thing, like, you know, that would just regularly fall off just because of, you know, there was so much stuff. It was mental. But yeah, that's you can kind of get the picture.
Yeah, I think so. I do this show with a lot of people, and I like the first band names. I like people's first bands because they're always, there's so much desire to be kind of portentous and mm-hmm. we are called the dot, dot, dot. Yeah, and you can hear pens being biroed into the back of jackets.
Oh, absolutely.
Come on,
then. Oh, I don't know, man. That's going to take a lot. I mean, there were tens of band names, but none of them made any sense.
Come on, let's have a couple.
I knew this day would come. There was, I'm trying to think of the least offensive one, like the least terrible one. I think me and Dom had a band called Garlic Farm for a while.
That could be worse.
Well, see, like, I didn't even know what garlic was. Like, everyone I told the name to was like, oh, I can just smell it, you know? I was like, what do you mean? Like, I was that kind of uncultured. I didn't even really know what garlic was when I was 11.
One more.
No, that's it. That's all you're going to get out of me.
That's all you're going to get.
I'm already regretting telling you.
If you say too many, they will follow you around online forever. So I do understand.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I do understand the reticence. First gig you played, we're moving forward here a bit now.
It was a concert put on by the music school that I went to. So my mum sent me, because I want to get drum lessons, she sent me to this kind of tuition place that was nearby our house. It was kind of this place you go, it was like an old converted house, and each room was like a little
study room,
yeah, and they had like drums and guitars, and like, you know, you go there and you choose what instrument you want to do. So I was like, I want to do drums, you know. So they would teach you drums. They always had like the coolest teachers, you know. The guy that taught me drums was like in this cool rock band in Perth, you know. I was like, this is, you know, it was just the coolest thing, because music had very recently just had taken over my identity, you know. Like, up until then I was kind of a bit of delinquent, or a bit of just get up to trouble, you know, with kids. But as soon as I started playing drums, it was like, it was complete
laser, complete, that's the only thing,
complete takeover of who
Brilliant.
I was. Yeah, so anyway, every Saturday, so they'd like pick kids that, like, they find a kid that played drums, find a kid that played guitar, and they put kids together in a band. So on Saturday, all the kids come together and play in a band. So I was like in a band of five. It was me and two other guys and two girls. Again, I was just like, this is the coolest thing imaginable. And so anyway, so every year they put on a concert where each band plays, you play two songs. I did a drum solo.
Of course you did.
I think my stepmom still has a video of that somewhere.
What was the songs? What did you do?
We did Sweet Child of Mine. We did Are You Gonna Go My Way? Oh, Lenny Kravitz. But what I really want to know is, are you gonna go my way? And I got to know it. And I also got put in a couple of other bands because I was showing Promise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the couple of other bands of sort of older people, like kind of mums and dads and stuff, that didn't have a drummer. So there was this all ladies band, and they did If You're Not In It For Love, I'm out of here. Shania Twain.
All right.
They did that. So I was in a band with some mums. That was cool.
But this is good for your chops.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, like, they just asked me not to hit as hard as I was. They were like,
a bit less of the boom one. Let's leap forward to the first professional band experience. So the first time you're like, okay, this is what we are doing. Someone might maybe give us some money for this. This is pro, even though it probably wasn't at the time, but it felt like...
Like the first time I received payment?
That's a good question, yeah.
For playing music? That would have been...
A year ago?
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. Only just. It would have been a Perth kind of local music scene gig because Dom and I kind of played in a few band competitions in Perth. Like, that was kind of the only thing I knew how to do to, like, play in front of an audience. Like, there's kind of band comps everywhere, you know. Battle of the Bands, Clash of the Bands, Next Big Thing, you know. Ampfest. It was all kind of this kind of stuff.
Ampfest, and that's good.
Yeah, all the different names. And that was all I knew, because I was still underage. I was still 17. So that was like, and I was out of school, but I was still 17. So we couldn't play in pubs yet. So it would have been as soon as I turned 18 that I played at some show where they have like 10 bands on, you know, and you're like the second band. And we would have got like $30 and a jug of... Swan Draft, which is like on the cheaper end of the spectrum.
Did you ever win anything?
Oh, in like band comps.
Yeah,
we came kind of like, actually we came second to this band called Mink Muscle Creek, which I later joined, and they're kind of my homies now. You know, we're all mixed up in the same thing. So yeah, but it's funny because up until that point, I didn't know how to process the fact that it was a competition of music, so I kind of just like became really competitive about it, you know. So I'd go and check out this band, like, oh, what are they doing, you know. Like, in hindsight, it was kind of like, it's great they were doing that, it's great for the community, that kind of stuff, but the idea of putting kids in band comps, those are such kind of formative years of experiencing playing live, and the fact that it was this kind of like competitiveness was injected to it, you know. I feel like maybe that's not the right way to introduce kids to music. But anyway, I was kind of competitive until I saw Mink Muscle Creek, and that all just kind of dissolved away. I was just like, I just want to be friends with these guys. I just want to, you know,
be part of that world.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to hang out with them. And like, we kind of instantly made friends. And the fact that it was a competition just instantly melted away. And we ended up coming first and second. So. And I was totally cool with that. I was like, no, you guys, you got this. This is all you.
Hey, That was They Dated Steadily by Mink Muscle Creek from their 2011 album Mink Muscle Manticore. Contemporaries and then bandmates of my guest here on The First Time This Week, Kevin Parker. And we'll be back with more from Kevin, talking about Tame Impala's breakthrough and keeping your musical mojo sacred when the world wants a piece of you, all after the Six Music News.
Six Music.
Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music. Welcome back. This is the show where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Kevin Parker from Tame Impala. And a very important first, and the moment that Tame Impala went public, was the very first release, the very first thing to bear their rather unique name. Beware, there's some very serious stationary chat coming up.
What was the first release that you were on? What was the first music that was out there that would have that name?
That would probably be our first EP.
Really?
Well, I mean, I sold copies of Tame Impala CDs for like $2 or whatever. Like a token amount, you know.
Do you sell many?
Yeah. I made them out of cardboard that I got from this law firm that I was working at. You know, because of law firms, they have these like manila folders. To make a file, you needed a whole manila folder that said like two, you know, like that. And you cut one. So you use one and a half things, and then there's this other one left over, and it's kind of like beige cream colored. You know that kind of color?
Yeah. Stationary color.
Stationary color, yeah. So that became the like color of the Tame Impala EPs.
Tell me about that first EP, because it's good sounding.
Oh, thanks.
You know, I mean, they've got a lot of character to them. Mm-hmm. Still, you listen to them today, and there is, I don't know, there's a real texture to that stuff.
Yeah, it's funny what kind of character can come out of something where the person has no idea what they're doing. I mean, that's basically why they have so much character. I had no idea what I was doing.
Because that's going to become the myth now. It's like, oh, yeah, you were just feeling your way around it. But that it was actually, that's the case.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. 100%. Like, I didn't understand the first concept of mixing and sound processing. Like, I knew what reverb was, you know? I knew what distortion was, but... But yeah, I mean, I haven't listened to those songs in ages. It's pretty difficult, so I'll get around to it.
Flaming Lips earlier. When did you first see the Flaming Lips? Because they're a band that kind of had a bit of an impact on...
Definitely.
...the world for you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think... as I said, I heard them... They had this song, Bad Days, that was on the Batman Forever soundtrack. And I didn't really know who they were. I kind of just, like... I just played the whole CD. And I was like, oh, this band's a Flaming Lips. I didn't later hear them until we saw them in Japan. We saw them live. And it was kind of just, like... just a different experience, you know. I wasn't ready for it, you know. Like, I thought they were kind of just going to be a band, you know. You know, like, that's a festival rock show, you know. Yeah. But like, I didn't realize how much kind of like how much of a thing that they just made out of everything they do. It's a terrible way of describing it, but it's just like the most kind of cosmic experience. The idea that it's a band on a stage is like a distant remnant of like what it started out as, you know. There's like,
exactly,
it's more of a cosmic theatrical show. Not theatrical in like terms of characters and stuff, but just it was just kind of throwing that basic kind of thing to the curb, you know. It was something completely different. It changed the way I look at live music.
We'll build up to the finale. No, we won't. We'll start with the finale.
Exactly.
And then we'll just keep going.
Exactly.
Because why? You know we're going to get there. So let's just get there now.
Exactly.
And make it great. In a speaker, talking about kind of myths around the band, the myth is that was an absolutely awful record to make. It was a very difficult record to make.
In a speaker?
Yeah. Is that true?
Well,
a hard...
Only in that every album is difficult to make. Only in that, you know,
it's never easy.
It's never easy. It kills a small part of you each time. You know, a small part of you dies every time you make an album. That's just the sacrifice. Only in that way, you know.
What do you remember from those sessions?
Well, I mean, we rented a house that was a few hours south of Perth, just kind of on this massive hill overlooking the beach. It's this crazy house. It's like a complete wooden shack, but it's the size of a mansion. And the views are just out of control. And so I would just sort of... I had everything set up in the main living room. And I would just kind of wake up and record for 6 weeks on end.
That sounds... Part of me, I just think, wow, that sounds brilliant. That sounds like a lovely...
Exactly. The reality of it was I didn't actually get a lot done. Because I'd wake up and record about like a 30-second or like a sort of a 16-bar thing. And it, like... Together that with the scenery, like take the intro, take the first song, like It's Not Meant to Be. I just have that on repeat for hours, you know, with the bass thing and the guitar thing, and like I'd be like, oh, okay, it's done, you know, like I don't need to do anything more today to feel like I've achieved something. I can just, the scenery made it seem like it was perfect, it was complete, you know, which can be the danger of being in a place that's too beautiful.
I never thought about that aspect of things. It's like, yeah, so what are you going to do? Everyone that listens to it, have they got to come here?
Exactly. No, but like, but albums that are made in a dingy apartment, you know, like staring out at a brick wall, suddenly when you'll do everything you can to make that music as lush and as beautiful and as kind of transportive as you can, and then when you listen to it in a place that is completely beautiful, it goes to another level, you know. Like if I'm ever kind of working on a song in my studio in Perth, and I've kind of like hit a wall with it, you know. I'm kind of like, oh, it's kind of like just a bit worn out on me. I just stick on the headphones and go for a walk, you know. I forgot how kind of revitalizing for a song that is. I just walk to the beach, you know. It's kind of just like the song has a new life. When it came time to finishing the album, that's when I lost it. You know, that's when the dying started, because I had to mix it, and I knew that record labels were waiting for it, fans that I now had were waiting for it, and it just did my head in. Now the EP, when we got signed, the EP was already done. I just selected songs that I already recorded in my bedroom, but recording the album, it was all fun while I was doing it, but when I had to finish it, it was like the pressure came down like a ton of bricks, you know. And so that's when, like, I was just like wasn't sleeping, and I had to go and mix it. Well, I went to mix it with Dave Fridman, who produced Flaming Lips, by no coincidence, you know. I was like, okay, I want to deal with that guy. I was jet lagged and just gone mental, basically.
About that track.
My wife asked me to play that, and I do what she tells me.
Rob Delaney.
Having a lot of fun playing my favorite tracks for you guys.
I'm really beginning to fall in love with you all out there.
I'm sort of an active music listener where it's hard for me to do other things well while I'm listening to music.
I remember the first time I heard this song when I was in high school. I was driving home from school. They played that song on the radio. The DJ said what it was,
and I just turned my car around and didn't drive home. I just drove to the record store.
This is Rob Delaney.
Weird and beautiful, like me.
This afternoon from 2 on BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
How did you, if you're moving on to Lonerism, then the audience gets bigger and things change. The thing, or you know, even if you don't, the world around you starts changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did you Because it's like, that's what you want. You want people to hear it, but you don't necessarily know what it's going to be like when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think you cope with it well? Are you enjoying it, this aspect of it?
It's difficult to say. It's pretty tough when you know everyone's hearing a song for the first time. Because up until that point, the song is mine, you know? Like, this is mine. This is my song. No one else has really heard it. Like, I mean, obviously, I have friends and manager and stuff. But the song is like, it belongs to me. It's kind of, it's a difficult thing to describe. But releasing it for the first time is always, it's always tough. It just, it feels like you're handing it over. It no longer belongs to me. It belongs to the people now. You know, it's like, well, pushing it off into the world. And then, so I usually can't listen to a song after I've released it for about a year.
A year?
Yeah. So like, every song. Every song. And it's only getting worse too. Like, when Lonerism came out, you know, I was obviously like loving the songs until then. And then it got released and I was like, oh. And we had to make a film clip for one of the songs. And I was like, I don't want to think about it, you know. Like, feels like we're going to go backwards. I was just like, I don't want to even. Well, I was like, it was kind of tough, you know. And then Currents happened. And Let It Happen came out. I thought it was trash. I thought it was like, how can anyone? I remember just thinking, like, how can anyone listen to this and think it's good?
Really?
Yeah. I'm sure some people currently think that, but I just remember thinking that reviewers that said it was great were just being lenient on me for some reason. I was trying to work out why they would be lenient on me, and I deduced that it was because I was Australian. I was like, maybe they think that Australians are kind of like. You know,
he needs a break. Let's be nice to him.
Right. I was like, maybe this is going easy because I'm Australian. Maybe they think Australians like aren't as sort of progressed with music. You know, like,
yeah, because reviewers often just are nice for no reason.
Well, exactly. I mean, like, that's the kind of delusion. That's the delusion that I'm talking about.
Tell me about that moment when people want a little piece of you, and that can be like, oh, wow, I get a chance to work with her and him. Mm-hmm. This is a great door to be opened. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, people want that thing that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing that you do becomes almost like a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a strange positive and negative environment to mm-hmm. be in.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. It's nice to feel wanted. Arguably, I started making music in the first place because I wanted to feel wanted, you know? And so when you, I mean, like, and that was like a tough thing for me to sort of digest too, that I had this thing that people wanted, you know, like I have this, and like, I know that I'm sure a lot of people find that kind of soul destroying, or they find it kind of like, oh, everyone's out to take my special sauce, you know,
but I'm going to take my picture and capture my soul.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, honestly, it kind of like, it couldn't be further from how I feel, you know. I like that I have this thing that I can offer that no one else can, you know. Like, to me, that's kind of like the epitome of having a craft or something, you know, having a special ability, or having a that's probably a much better word that I can't think of right now, but it makes me feel like I have something kind of unique to offer. I mean, obviously you have to be careful with it, because as you say, everyone will take a piece and then it won't be special anymore.
If everyone has your sauce, it's not a special sauce anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it is if you keep the recipe a secret. But
and you let people have just a little tiny bit on their burger, maybe just on the side.
Right, right. But people are smart these days. You know, that's why you got to keep changing your recipe, because people are smart. People will work out how something is done, you know.
How do we feel about Glastonbury? This is a site of a former triumph for you. It's a place that fits in your world, I think.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I can't wait. It's the greatest festival in the world, you know? Like, I don't need to tell an English person that, do I? I mean, yeah, I can't wait.
How was it when you went the first time? Because people don't really know even if you think you know what it's going to be like, you don't really know what it's like till you get it. Can you remember first kind of stepping off the tour bus and going, okay.
Yeah. I remember thinking it was like Middle Earth, you know, the first time, or like maybe even the first two times that we went, we didn't really like do Glastonbury, you know, we were kind of like almost intimidated by the size of it. I mean, we were instantly struck by how non-music festival-y everyone's attitude was. Like, everyone was just loving it, you know, but we didn't really like sort of know anyone that was staying there. I don't think we slept there. I think we played our show and left, you know. It was only kind of like, I think like every year we've kind of like delved deeper into Glastonbury, you know. Last year was pretty, we were there until Monday morning, and I have no idea what's going to happen this year, but I feel like it's best not to have any expectation or any plan, you know. Just let Glastonbury do its thing.
I kind of even feel bad for asking you what's happening with the next record, because you're kind of, I'd rather just let you get on with it and not ask you, but it's kind of my job to ask you about it.
Sure, you can. You can.
How's it going?
It's going good. Yeah, it's going good. I mean, like, I've obviously got a strong filter on at the moment, but it's going good. I'm really excited. I mean, yeah.
What's the last song we should play? We're going to go on a song that's a choice of yours.
Ah.
Anything you want. It can be something you've loved for your whole life or heard this morning, something of yours or someone...
Oh, Jay really likes this song by Jayapal. It's called Do You Love Her Now? He got me onto the other morning. It's really cool. But I must stress, it's his find, guys. It's not this... I didn't find this song. Because this is kind of Jay will get angry at me for. Like, hey, that was my find. You know, I found this track because he loves Jayapal. So I got to give him credit for that discovery there.
It's been good to speak to you. Thank you so
much.
Cool.
Thanks, man.
Was Do You Love Her Now by Jayapal, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time this week, Kevin Parker, or more accurately, the choice of Jay Watson from Tame Impala. We need to be very clear about that. If you missed anything from the show, you can listen again on the BBC Sounds app. Next week, we're taking a break because of the Glastonbury Festival, but we're back after that with a new first-time guest, soul hero, P.P. Arnold. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.